the San Francisco Experience podcast, brought to you by Jim Herlihy. Independent commentary from a Silicon Valley perspective for a global audience, featuring newsmakers, thought leaders, and authors. Season 25, Episode 16, Super Tuesday Results and the California Primary, talking with Professor David McEwen. Our guest today is Professor David McEwen, Chair of the Political Science Department at Sonoma State University. He's also a regular political analyst on KCBS Radio and numerous TV stations, KPIX, KTVU, and KRON, where his expertise and insights are sought after. He joins us from his office on campus at Sonoma State University. Good morning, David, and welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, and welcome to the day after.
Yes. David, I enjoyed watching you last night on KRON and your analysis of the results, both nationwide and here in California. It must have been a very late night.
It was a late night. It was a late night all across the world for the work I do. But, you know, for me, election night is like, you know, the World Series, March Madness, and the Super Bowl all rolled into one. So I really love it. And election night lasts basically 4 days, and then we get to the data. So in that sense, it's good to love what you do and to try to do it as hard and as well as you can. And I certainly strive for that.
Well, David, you do it very well. And you were telling me before we went on the air, some of the, in addition to the KRON coverage last night, a lot of international interviews you did today, and you have another 12 interviews lined up after this podcast. So let's get right to the heart of the matter. Let's start with the presidential primaries and move on to California. What was your overall thought of last night's results?
There were four big questions, I think, when you look at the broad landscape of Super Tuesday across the country. Will Nikki Haley be in or out? We have resolution to that. Really, I would say before she announced this morning that she was suspending her campaign and she's out, because she flew home to South Carolina. And in the process of doing that, what she's signaling is that she's headed home to take stock. And even though she wins Vermont, the writing clearly was on the wall. I think that was a big thing to watch. Another component is the never Donald Trump, anti-Donald Trump component of the vote. What that looks like, it's depending where you go, between 25% of the Republican electorate to say mid-30s. It's around 30% of the Republican electorate. That's an important component for November. And how does Joe Biden do with his base? Dean Phillips drops out today. Obviously, the president loses American Samoa, but he does clean up. But post-Michigan, that uncommitted component that we see prominently in states like 20% or so in Minnesota, we see this in North Carolina, Massachusetts, and Colorado, that uncommitted component, particularly of young people or emerging voters between 18 and 35, who don't participate at a high level in an early California primary, but they are an important component of the Democratic base moving forward, they're still disgruntled, particularly about the issue of Gaza, human rights, and what is happening in the Middle East. And then the fourth component is the Golden State. California really matters. It is wild times here. You're going to see a Senate race that set records move to the fall between Adam Schiff, who basically funded and picked his opponent, Steve Garvey, by spending a quarter of his money to elevate Steve Garvey on television, while Garvey doesn't really have to do much. He doesn't have to say much. That changes in the fall. And then you've got these kind of down ballot races for what happens in Congress, like, for example, in Congressional District 22, that's the David Baladeo district. And you have a ballot measure that the governor puts on the ballot relative to mental health and homeless and mental health treatment facilities that is barely winning.
Yes.
And any number under 52 is really a statement for where voters are at and is an important element for the fall. It will pass, it looks like, but nonetheless, it gives us an idea where voters are at. And if you're the governor and you barely eke through a victory for a ballot measure that doesn't have any opposition, you have to take stock of that. That also buoys Republicans and buoys that kind of fledgling potential second recall attempt at Governor Newsom as we head to the fall as well. So there's a lot going on in these big ticket questions that we came out of yesterday with and with the California and certainly if you will, regional focus around San Francisco.
Before we come back to the California Senate race, let's just focus on, for a moment, on the Trump race. It looks as though he has wrapped up the nomination there. So it was a foregone conclusion almost from the get-go, but it looks as though that race is over. Let's just focus for a moment on the Biden race. You mentioned the uncommitted vote in Michigan, Minnesota, Colorado, Massachusetts, upwards of 20% in some of those states. You also mentioned off the air that here in California, we didn't see that uncommitted, we didn't see a similar kind of uncommitted vote in this state. But is there any possibility of that uncommitted movement of, again, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, all the M's, Colorado, any possibility of that uncommitted vote coalescing and kind of jeopardizing Biden's coronation at the Chicago convention this summer?
Right. As you're, that's a great question, because as your learned audience knows, right, Chicago 1968 was a watershed moment in American politics and for the modern Democratic Party. Since 1968, American politics has dramatically changed. Obviously, that was the Vietnam War, the Civil Rights Movement, the election of Richard Nixon, and also the demise and change in how the Democratic Party elects its president, nominates it, or elects its nominee, moves to its nominee. And in that process, it was hugely divisive. It was televised. And if you're the Biden team, you do not want to, you know, they've got 77% of the delegates that they need so far. Mm-hmm. There is no race there, just like there is nothing in terms of suspense about Donald Trump. However, for the Biden team, you don't want to give too much room or running room or political legs to what's going on relative to this uncommitted block of voters. That is a potential problem for them. And what it really does, I think, Jim, is set up the speech of Joe Biden's political life tomorrow night for the State of the Union. He has to lay down the gauntlet to Republicans about the stark choice, but he also has to lay out what is going to happen relative to an appeal to these 18 to 35 voters who are interested in social justice and human rights. And as a result, they have changed how they feel about the situation in Israel. They have a different relationship to what is going on there and understanding. And there's a lot of thinly veiled components to that belief. Mm-hmm. But it is a concern for Democrats moving forward because, just as a reminder, 93 million people who were eligible to vote in 2016 did not vote. The overwhelming majority of those emerging voters were younger voters, newer voters. Mm-hmm. And we all know what happened in 2016. That number is larger still, headed to 2024, while the electorate is experiencing this dramatic, big demographic shift. That's challenging a Democratic Party that has an 80-year-old, 80-plus-year-old running here for president, and also challenges the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. So these changes, the issues, hugely important, while you have in the background what's going on with student loans, what's going on with economic vitality, their own concerns that they have, while the events of the Middle East are happening. And this is where the best laid plans of campaigns can go awry or sideways, because the Biden team was hoping they could announce a ceasefire. They could talk about developments in the Middle East that would calm these uncommitted voters, particularly these younger voters. We don't see that happening headed into tomorrow night, into Thursday, the State of the Union. Instead, you may see a focus on Alexander Navalny's widow, a discussion about Vladimir Putin, about what they're doing. But nonetheless, it's going to continue to churn. And that is a big, big concern for Democrats and for the Biden team moving forward.
Mm-hmm. David, do you see a ceasefire in Gaza? I mean, Gaza is not going to go away if there is a ceasefire in Gaza. I mean, that issue has galvanized those voters and many other voters, but it's absolutely galvanized them. So even with a ceasefire, the underlying issues that those uncommitted voters in Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Colorado, that Gaza issue, do you see that going away anytime soon in November? And if so, what can the Biden administration do to neutralize that issue and take it off the table and remove it from a potential threat from these young voters sitting out the November election?
Right. So it's not too late to make amends with those, with that 18 to 35 emerging voter demographic. But the window is closing because even with the ceasefire, the issue of Bibi Netanyahu, the issue of what to do with the Israeli government after October 7th, or if elections are called or happen during the next couple of months, during the fall campaign period in the United States, for example, that issue doesn't go away. And so the Biden team is faced with managing a whole host of suboptimal decisions, of what we call wicked or sticky problems, things that persist, like moving towards a two-state solution, like trying to aim for negotiations and peace in the Middle East, or a normalization of relations that might occur, for example, between the Israelis and the Saudis, or other elements of the Middle East, other governments there. So it doesn't go away. They are running out of time, and we're entering into this place where they're going to lose a block of voters. That block of voters are much less wed or tied to or anchored to political party. Mm-hmm. They moonlight in a political party. They hang out with Bernie Sanders because he speaks to them. They hang out or moonlight with elements of other political parties and sometimes fringe movements. And that's where a regional candidacy, like an RFK Jr. in the Northeast, or in a battleground state like Georgia, Nevada, Arizona, could be very important, because a third party that takes away 1, 2, or 3%, and you add up RFK Jr. and Cornel West and Jill Stein, and all of a sudden you have a counter-protest movement that makes a battleground state much less hospitable to both parties. That's important, but could potentially come with an emerging voter bloc at slightly higher cost to Democrats than to Republicans, and therefore moves Donald Trump closer to the 270 electoral votes that he needs.
Well, we're talking about RFK Jr. It was just announced yesterday that he had reached the magic number of signatures in Nevada, so he'll be on the Nevada ballot. You mentioned that he's already on the Georgia ballot, I think the Arizona ballot. How many ballots is he on? Is he actually on? I also heard that he was interviewing with the Libertarian Party to see if he might get that nomination. That would be very far-fetched, just given his position on gun control and their position on gun rights. But just very quickly, where does RFK stand at this point in terms of the states where he's eligible to run today?
Right. So if you look at RFK and where he's at, this development yesterday of qualifying for the ballot in Nevada, announced on Super Tuesday with the help of his PAC, is a big development. The reason it's a big development is there's a lot that happens in Nevada, particularly in two counties. I look at 12 to 15 counties and what happens in those 12 to 15 counties across the country as a proxy for a barometer or indicator of what will happen in the general election. Obviously, Clark County, where Las Vegas is at, and Washoe County, where Reno is located, are hugely important to the outcome. And RFK Jr. gets a draw. So that development for Nevada is a big deal. You also want to pay attention to his what's called We the People Party. They've qualified in six states. Mm. They recently announced they also have acquired a place on Hawaii on the ballot. And Utah was ironically the first state in which he qualified to appear on the ballot. But he's gathered enough signatures to be on the ballot in Arizona and Georgia. These are also states like Maricopa County in Arizona, Gwinnett, Fulton County, those two counties in Georgia. Those three states between Nevada, Arizona, and Georgia, the only state that's an outlier there for really having a heavy weight on the results of the presidential election in 2024 is Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And Pennsylvania is obviously the state that Joe Biden was born in, spends a lot of time there. You get qualified in Pennsylvania, and all of a sudden, disgruntled voters, the uncommitted component, can become something that you're concerned about privately and perhaps even publicly if you're the Biden team. It's something really to watch and manage. especially as RFK Jr. searches for potential access to the ballot more broadly, like through, for example, the Libertarian Party.
Well, Nevada, Arizona, and Georgia put Joe Biden over the top in 2020, number one.
Exactly.
And number two, Arizona and Nevada, both neighbors of California, Arizona and Nevada have always liked the maverick kind of candidate. Whether it's in Arizona, it was John McCain or Barry Goldwater. In Nevada, it was Paul Laxalt. So both of those states have a tradition of gravitating towards maverick candidates. So RFK Jr. could be, you know, he could siphon away up to 5-10% of the vote, which in a close run contest could swing it one way or the other.
Yeah, I think there's a couple components here. One is there was polling back in November and in February. In the November Siena College poll, they looked at six battleground states. Okay, so they looked at the state, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. Those are the states that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And they found that slightly more Democrats than Republicans would back Kennedy Jr. However, there's also an element of height or exaggeration to that width. It seems to over-exaggerate the Democratic kind of poll than it does the Republican. And then you add on to it more recent polls, like Quinnipiac, I think it was last month in February, that found that you add Kennedy Jr., and Cornel West and Jill Stein, and you start to get to a place that 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 points of registered voters. And when that happens, it sinks Joe Biden in those states. And even if that is an exaggeration in the polling, as a complex component of disgruntlement with the major parties, let's say it's half that number. Let's say it's 5 points or 4 points or 3 points. All of a sudden, states like Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, Michigan, Arizona, Wisconsin, all of a sudden those are in the Trump category because, due to the Electoral College, Democrats are kind of siloed and without delivering the vote or the disaffected vote. That also could be a problem for turnout, especially amongst those emerging voters that are also more diverse at 18 to 35 as well.
Mm-hmm. Let's move on to California. California, of course, it's our home state. We represent 52 of the 270 electoral votes. Of course, presidential candidates use us as an ATM machine. They come here to raise funds. They really don't have to campaign because registration is so heavily Democratic. The state is pretty much in the bag for a Democratic candidate. Talk to me about yesterday's primary, and in particular, the Senate race. We had, of course, the late Senator Dianne Feinstein, former mayor of San Francisco. She held that seat from 1992 until last year. She held it for over 32 years. Mm-hmm. So it's very rare that a Senate seat is open. And this was our first open contest for that seat in over 30 years. Give us some of the dynamics of the race and why on earth did Adam Schiff propel a Republican into second place? In any other state, you'd say, this is craziness.
This is one of the beautiful things about California, its politics, and also the measure of the importance of what happened in the Senate race, even in a deeply blue state like California. The last time a Republican was elected to statewide office, 2006, with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Steve Poizner, an insurance commissioner. But if you look back to the recall of Gray Davis in 2003, when Arnold comes in, California is much more deeply blue than it's ever been. Almost one out of two California registered voters are registered as a Democrat, about 46%. Mm-hmm. Republicans, about a quarter, and that no party preference, those independents, who will be important in the fall, that number is running about 20-21%. So you've got these California voters, but they're less wed to party, even though it's bluer. You go and you fast forward and you look at the legacy of Dianne Feinstein. You look at the importance of what's been happening in California politics. And there are two things that are resolute of how California and the Democratic Party has gone. And one of those has been that the Democratic Party has been centered in the Bay Area. It's been centered in San Francisco. And we are in the midst of generational change, where you're also not going to see a U.S. senator, a Senate candidate on the ballot who's from San Francisco. Mm-hmm. It is a generational change where Nancy Pelosi is closer to being done than not. where someone like Barbara Lee runs for the race on the progressive side, an anti-war progressive, a staunch defender of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, who is in a distant fourth place, despite her long kind of giant role on the progressive side. You see change in what's in the political fortunes of Governor Newsom. Even though he's a national political figure now, he's also someone who's experiencing some bumps headed into November and the presidential election. You see Kamala Harris, the vice president, hugely important, but also someone who sometimes gets lost in a shuffle. You look at this Senate race, Katie Porter, Southern California, Adam Schiff, Southern California, Steve Garvey, Southern California, and Adam Schiff spends a quarter of his money. He and his PACs spent about $40 million of the $71 million that were spent in this race. He spends $10 million elevating Steve Garvey, advertising on television. Steve Garvey doesn't even advertise on television. He doesn't have to. And in the campaign where he doesn't really say that much, he underperforms in the debates. He does just, quote unquote, fine. And he's kind of low energy. And it's unclear what it means to be a moderate conservative. This is the label he puts on himself. And when he talks about specific issues like touching the homeless or connecting with people or consensus and trying to build or avoid conflict and trying to build cooperation, he's often abstract. And he's also someone who supports Donald Trump, who is popular in the Republican Party, even in California, of course, but not popular amongst Californians. All of that sets up a situation where Adam Schiff grabs the California Democratic congressional establishment. He gets 3 out of 4 members of Congress to endorse him. He's making calls up and down the ballot. He's calling mayors and city council members. He's calling well-known Democrats and those that are emerging Democrats to build a base and a fundraising juggernaut that swamps everyone else. He's in the lead the whole time. And I think there is some writing on the wall here. Not that Steve Garvey wins in this deeply blue state. No, it's that the arrogance of their approach, the we are winning, we are ahead, we are always polling consistently ahead, and we can raise money. That raises the ire of Democrats inside and elites. They don't like to talk about that, but it certainly puts them in, Adam Schiff in a place where he is the favorite Democrat next to maybe Nancy Pelosi and the revered Willie Brown that Republicans love to hate. And how Schiff handles that moving forward will be interesting, because sometimes, quite frankly, he's a robotic politician and not exactly a giver, if you will, of understanding the moment. And let me illustrate one quick element of this. Last night, he gives a speech, his supposed to be his victory speech, and there are a number of protesters scattered throughout the facility talking about Gaza and Israel and that situation. There are people behind him and all around. He continues on. Nancy Pelosi would have never done that. Nancy Pelosi would have said, rightly so, I hear you. And now it's my turn to speak. Won't you give me the opportunity to respond and to speak as well? And Adam Schiff didn't do that. And his people didn't get him off the stage. That is a problem, because you're wearing out your welcome. And it's, quite frankly, just not good practical politics.
It was a bad omen. On the night that he should have been celebrating his victory, that he's been working to, that's been his ambition for decades, where he should have been celebrating, he was left flat-footed. He let them protest. He stood there for, it seemed, minutes, not saying anything, and letting them chant Gaza, Gaza, or ceasefire, whatever it was they were chanting. What exactly, David, what were the ending numbers? What percentage did he get, Steve Garvey, Katie Porter, and Lee? Do you recall what the latest results are?
Yeah, sure. So know for your listeners that there's a number of outstanding tallies that are still there. So while we might see, for example, that we have all precincts reporting, what we have in California are all precincts partially reporting. So there's votes that could change percentages on the margins. But look, Steve Garvey is going to end up 3 to 5 points ahead of Adam Schiff.
Really?
That's a big deal.
Really?
Yes. He's going to, in the final analysis, end up 3 to 5 points ahead of Schiff. Garvey's going to have about 35% of the vote. Schiff is going to have about 31% of the vote. All right. Katie Porter is distant in third place at about 16, and Barbara Lee will hover between 8 to 9% in the final analysis. If Barbara Lee doesn't get to double figures, that's an important element as well, because her campaign never seemed to kind of grab traction on the progressive active left, and those voters don't seem to have shown up as well in this primary election. Katie Porter there kind of stuck in this place where she has to thread the needle somewhere, and her campaign did not pivot after Steve Garvey entered the race. They were aiming for second place. It looked great from their perspective. They were unable to pivot, and Steve Garvey is going to end up number one, top vote getter, Adam Schiff in second place. But when you coalesce that Democratic vote that's out there, roughly 31% for Schiff, roughly 16% for Katie Porter, and you add in Barbara Lee's 8, 9, 10%, you're talking about 60% of the vote that was cast yesterday is on the Democratic side. And all of that helps Adam Schiff in the fall at the expense, most likely, of Steve Garvey.
Well, Schiff's strategy to boost Garvey was successful beyond any measure. For Steve Garvey to come in first was probably never foreseen by the Schiff people. So will Porter and Lee ever forgive Schiff for doing what he did? For putting this Trump supporter, Steve Garvey, into first place?
That is a golden question, and here's why. If you think about last night and what happened, what should be Schiff's signature shining moment, interrupted by protesters, Adam Schiff needs Katie Porter and Barbara Lee to help bring down the temperature of those activists against Adam Schiff, one of the strongest proponents and supporters of Israel in the U.S. Congress. That is not going to happen. The bad blood that Katie Porter has about how Adam Schiff elevated Garvey, attacked Porter, about the independent expenditure money that made this the most expensive Senate race in our history, $71 million, right? 250% more than the last three U.S. Senate races in California. Mm-hmm. That bad blood is not going to change anytime soon. And there is anyone who could provide political cover for Adam Schiff on the issue of Gaza and Israel and what we saw last night in terms of protests, it's Barbara Lee. And Barbara Lee isn't going to do this anytime soon as well, because she's a class act and certainly a progressive icon. But she's also someone who's going to want to extract something from Adam Schiff and not going to do it just for the goodness of the team. And Schiff is going to be coming to these two to do something to help him for the goodness of TD, Team Democrat. Mm-hmm. And Team Democrat is what Adam Schiff is all about. He's given Katie Porter over $200,000 over the last couple of election cycles to help her. He's certainly buoyed up key elements for progressive legislation that Barbara Lee and others would support. But he's not in a place where, while he needs their help, he's in a driver's seat to get that, even though he demolished them in this primary, partly because of this strategy of elevating Steve Garvey, not because of Steve Garvey as a capable candidate, but because of Steve Garvey's weaknesses, pure and simple.
David, are there any other down ballot candidates, races, or issues that you'd like to highlight, down ballot here on the California primary ballot, that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. One is Proposition 1, the ballot measure that had no opposition related to mental health. Obviously, that's a neck-and-neck race. That's an important kind of barometer of where California voters are at. And if you think about Adam Schiff elevating Steve Garvey, Nikki Haley is still in the race, and Trump is popular in the California Republican Party, Schiff is helping drive out Republican voters in this particular primary. That hurts the ballot measure Proposition 1. In addition, you look down ballot at a congressional seat like Congressional District 22. This is a district that's in the Central Valley. David Valadao is the Republican who represents that district, but it's a district that Joe Biden won by double digits. Democrats were really worried that David Valadao and Chris Mathis, both Republicans, would knock out Rudy Salas. Salas is a Democrat and kind of the establishment Democrat anointed candidate who lost to David Valadao last general election. That Rudy Salas and Melissa Hurtado. Melissa Hurtado is a state senator, Hurtado won her Senate re-election by 13 votes, the closest state Senate election in California history. Hurtado was buoyed by Emily's List and other Democratic-leaning women's groups. Hurtado is in there, Salas is in there, and they're going at it. These two Democrats are just beating the heck out of each other, and Democratic operatives really worry that Chris Mathis on the Republican side and the incumbent David Valadao would be able to move forward in a reap-on-reap race, Republican-on-Republican race, when potentially Democrats have that on their national target list to pick up a district that Joe Biden wins against Valadao. From the results we have so far, it looks like they can breathe a sigh of relief. Rudy Salas is in second place. Valadao is in first place. That particular race, Congressional District 22, is going to receive national attention and national money, something to watch as we move into the fall. Because if California or if Democrats want to win the House and come back into the majority, they have to go through California and New York. It's the George Santos seat in New York. It's the holding on to the Katie Porter seat in Southern California, or Congressional District 22 that Democrats are going to need to get back into the majority in the House.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, in the remaining few minutes of the podcast, what are the takeaways from the Super Tuesday and California primary?
I think there are some big takeaways. One is Super Tuesday, while a big tradition that really began 1980, 1984, accelerates in 1988, is a big deal in terms of its weight. But an early primary, a short runway to, you know, learn about candidates, to pay attention to what's going on, also meets straight head on with voters who are looking for something that motivates them and their interests. You don't see that really going on. You have two, if you will, conventional candidates who are going to end up in a rematch from 4 years ago in a very divisive election. Look, this particular election, we always say this, right? The election of our lifetime, the most important election ever. This 2024 presidential election looks like it's going to be the most important election since not 1968, since 1860, just before the Civil War. That's a big deal. And that means that perception of Donald Trump, perception of Joe Biden is going to matter in a big way. And politics is moving at lightning speed. And voters turn off from this at some level. I call it, again, junk food politics. You consume it and feel bad afterwards after you've done that. But it sets up what is potentially the most negative and divisive election in American political history. And voters are worried about that. Voters are upset, for example, on the Democratic side about Gaza, what's happening overseas, and concerned about their pocketbooks. And there are a contingent of Republicans who will not vote for Donald Trump. And we see that with the persistence of Nikki Haley's candidacy, at least through Super Tuesday, where she's kicked out despite winning a state like Vermont. And finally, I'd say California matters in a really big way, but maybe in some unexpected ways as well, because we're experiencing a generational change where, particularly on the Democratic side, in the deeply blue state, the nexus of decision-making and influence is moving from Northern California and from the Bay Area to Southern California, reflecting this kind of generational shift and divide that we expect to accelerate with Democratic Party politics and Republican Party politics in California, especially headed into the next cycle of 2026 to 2028.
And David, how can our listeners follow you?
Well, of course, they can always email me at the university. They can always Google me. And I'm on LinkedIn now, so that's at least some progress. I still haven't made it to X or Twitter yet.
Okay. Well, once again, David, thank you very much for taking the time to join us today, sharing your insights. And I know you've got a full dance card for the rest of the day, another 12 interviews coming up later today. So again, thank you for taking the time to be with us today, sharing your insights. And we look forward to staying in touch with you during convention season and subsequently into the general election.
I look forward to it as well, Jim. You know I'm a big fan of this podcast. I love the work you do, and it's partly not just you, your personality. It's those great questions that you ask and the great guests that you get. I'm not putting myself in that category. Just a very, very interesting podcast, and I really, really appreciate your work.
Well, I would put you in that category. It's up to me. I'm the host, so I'm putting you in that category. Again, David, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's such a pleasure.
And for our listeners, today's episode is number 503. Listen to us on Apple, Spotify, Pandora, 18 platforms, and join our listener base in 60 countries. FeedSpot has recognized us as a top 25 California news podcast, ranking us number 12. This has been the San Francisco Experience Podcast with Jim Herlihy, coming to you from San Francisco.